and welcome to Storytelling.
Yay!
Thank you all for coming. I used to do this at Bristol Valley Theater, but I live in Seneca Falls now, so this is my first one here, and I'm really excited that we got quite a few people. I'm really grateful the packed house has let us do it. So, as this is my first one, I'm going to tell you why storytelling. Like, why do I care so much about storytelling that I would bother to put this on for free? Well, I don't get paid. I mean, you are all supposed to have paid, and if you didn't, like, report to the front, and they'll beat you and throw you out. Why storytelling? Well, I don't know, like, I guess, you know, a few years back, you know, when I stopped, like, drinking, sleeping around, I found out there's a lot more hours in the day than I thought there was. But no, like, really, like, I started doing this, I think, I'm going to be honest, like, spite. Don't knock it, it's a really powerful motivator. I was on Facebook, and I was ranting and raving at somebody who was ranting and raving back at me, and this happens a lot. And he was like, the problem, and the reason you don't understand my point, is because you don't listen. And I'm not going to say this guy wasn't like an ignorant tool bag, because he was. But he was right. He had a point. I don't listen. And a lot of us don't listen to each other. Especially now. Like, I don't know if you've ever tried it, like, but from my experience, no one ever changes anything by me not talking to them. Nobody's like, oh no, Sarah's not talking to me. I've hit rock bottom. I better change my ways. Like, if anything, like, they don't care. Moreover, they don't notice. And that is the worst thing. Like, you've been snubbing someone for, like, weeks on end, and you finally see them at the grocery store, and they're like, oh, hey, how are you? I haven't seen you in forever. Like, how's the family? And you're like, oh, so you're finally ready to apologize. And they look at you blankly, like, come again? And it's just really embarrassing. So I decided the topic tonight was going to be the end of a decade, because it is. It's the end of an era. And we're all lots of different people through our time on this world. And we all have this amazing story to tell. We have these fantastic stories that are better than the movies about love and loss and failure and redemption. And they're so exciting, but we never tell them, mostly because no one ever asks us. So that's why we're here tonight. We're asking, and we're going to listen, and we're going to get to know each other a little. And some of you may know some of the speakers, and you may think you know them, and maybe you don't, and maybe you'll never see these people again in your life, but it doesn't matter, because as soon as you know somebody's story, there's a little piece of them in you. And I hope that if we're all going to listen to these stories, that when we walk out of here, we'll be just a little more open-minded than we were when we started. Yeah, and my whole tagline was this, is the more you know about someone, the harder it is to hate them. Which is mostly true. So first up, I have a younger speaker. He hasn't had as many decades, but he's a very interesting guy at a very interesting point in his life. I asked him for a bio, and he said he's an aspiring man about town.
That was a different thing I said.
Okay, he will. I'm going to bring him up to stage, and he can talk about it. This is Luke Riegel, and he's very interesting.
I'm going to stand. Should I talk into it like this? Or like this? Is this on? Is it on?
Yeah.
No. Great. I think my bio was an aspiring local character.
Yes, you are.
The weirdo standing on the corner talking to no one. That's me. What?
That's already
been filmed. There are never enough. Okay, hi. Hello. I have literally never done something like this before, so I beg your indulgence if I sputter. Sarah invited me to do this because there was a space to fill, and initially I was just like, yeah, maybe, no, probably not, but maybe. And she asked again, and I said, maybe, but probably no. And she asked again, and I said, maybe, but probably no. And then I was thinking one night, if I don't do it, I might regret it. I might not, but I don't want to not do it and then have that regret. So here I am now. And I had asked initially, I think I was like, do I need to be funny? Because I've tried being funny in front of people and it didn't really work. And she said no. And then I said, do I have to talk for the whole 15 minutes? And she said no. And then I said, well, what do I need to do? And she said, don't be boring. Because if you're boring, we take you out back and beat you. This seems to be a theme with her.
She told me that, too.
Yeah. So, thinking about the theme of what I learned over the last decade. I'm 30 now. What did I learn during my 20s? I could probably really pick at that and come up with some things that are probably too raw for me to talk about in front of a room of mostly strangers. So I was like, well, what can I say? And I was thinking, well, I've got this mildly okay story about this time I met a puppet, so I'm gonna tell that one. But it probably needs a little context. So, 30 years old, right now, I couldn't tell you what I want to do with my life. I used to want to write comic books. Before that, I wanted to write daytime soap operas. Before that, I wanted to make slasher films. Before that, I wanted to write Broadway musicals. Before that, I wanted to write the next Gone with the Wind because I was 12 years old and I really loved Gone with the Wind for some reason. Of course, none of these things I've really found myself primed for success in doing. They're kind of the kind of thing that if you want success, whoa. If you want success in the entertainment industry, you know, writing novels, making films, doing whatever, you need connections. You need a network. And I've struggled with social anxiety for, well, all 30 of these years. You know, things like talking in front of a crowd are particularly difficult. But even one-on-one interactions can be pretty tough. I blame going to Catholic school on that. Not the Catholic part, but the part where I was one of a class of 12. You know, and it's tough to develop social skills when you're one of a class of 12, especially when you like Gone with the Wind. And I don't know what the other kids liked, but it wasn't Gone with the Wind. So, you know, it's a struggle being out there in the world and being noticed and wanting to do, you know, what you dream of doing when you have a hard time, you know, talking one-on-one, when one-on-one interaction is very difficult for you. And I've been lucky, really lucky in some ways. You know, I got into Ithaca College for film, basically based on my own merits. I didn't know anybody there. I interned at the Young and the Restless in Los Angeles for a summer, you know, entirely based on my own resume. I didn't know anybody there. But a lot of the other things that I've been successful with have sort of been, you know, because of this lineage of connections I made. So we could talk about how I wanted to work in comics. And so I would go to Comic-Con with these two guys who are professionals in the comic book industry. But I met them because one of them knew my friend Laura. I knew my friend Laura because she knew my roommate Katie. I knew my roommate Katie because she was part of this friend group that I sort of got subsumed into my freshman year of college because I got randomly placed in a dorm because I didn't know anybody. So I look at that experience going to these conventions with these two guys who worked in the industry that I had wanted to work in, and it was entirely luck. And so it wasn't something where I overcame my struggle with you know, social anxiety to get there. And so that kind of brings us around to the puppet. Because going to New York Comic Con, wanting to be a writer in comic books, there's a lot of networking events, which for someone like me are difficult. You go into a bar full of people you don't know with the expectation of developing like these professional connections like right there on the spot. So it was 1 year at Comic-Con. There was a networking event, me and the other assistant for these two guys we were working for. We decided to go. Knowing our, she kind of has some of the same issues I do, so we sort of had a plan. We were just like, all right, we're going to walk into the bar, and we're going to find someone who's open, and we're just going to go up, and we're going to say hi and make small talk, and that's what we're going to do. We're not going to let this, like, stop us. We're not going to hang in a corner by ourselves. So we go into the bar. We sort of suck it up. We find the first person we find is this girl. She's just kind of off, you know. She had been talking to people, and they kind of moved on. So we're like, that's her. We're going to move right in. So we go in. We start chatting her up. Hello, how are you? What's your name? What do you do? How are you enjoying the con? And so we're kind of making small talk. And all of a sudden, she goes, excuse me, I need to go. And she runs to the other side of the bar. And we're just like, wow, really, really killing this one, aren't we? So we sort of hang out on our own for a second, and then she comes back. And we're like, oh, wow, that's great. Well, at least it wasn't a total failure. She came back. And she says to us the statement, I'm sorry. It's just that I saw someone on the other side of the bar with a puppet shirt on. And us puppet people have to stick together. Okay. And without even asking, she takes her hand, she reaches it into her bag, and it emerges with this little purple monster puppet thing on it. And she begins to speak to us in the voice of the puppet, which was very awkward. Because I can't talk to people. I don't know how to talk to a puppet. And it's made worse by the fact that I was like, oh, yes, very cute, very cute, very cute puppet. Anyway, you are, you're at this con because, and she goes, no, don't talk to me, talk to the puppet. Don't talk to me, talk to the puppet. And the puppet proceeds to give us its life story. It's apparently the child of John Stamos in a washcloth. Didn't want to know that. Thank you. And so it's me and the other assistant, two very anxious people, suddenly stuck in a very awkward situation. And we were eventually saved by the fact that some other people come walking over, and they go, excuse me, but is that a puppet I see? Because apparently they were big puppet fans who'd never seen a puppet before. So she sort of focuses her attention on them, and we're like, all right, we're out of here. We're out the other way. And so that was the night I met a puppet. And it sort of came in the middle of a particularly anxious decade of my 20s. And if I were to think about it, you know, the beginning of my 20s, night of the puppet, and now, you could probably chart it on a graph. There's a rising to it. You know, because when I think about where I started at the beginning of my 20s, if someone would have asked me, hey, do you want to come do storytelling night? I would have said no, and then regretted it. Whereas now, at least, I didn't say no. Thank you.
light, Luke. You can rest easy. You weren't boring, so we're not going to hurt you. So these are slopes that you've filled out. I'm going to read a few of them. So the first one. How are you a different person now than you were 10 years ago? I'm 67 and I'm really older and wiser now than I was 10 years ago. I'm slower, more patient, more truly loving and appreciative of life than I was at 47. I'm shorter, wider, and more conservative. I do like the idea of eating dessert first. I have more confidence in myself and my abilities, but I'm less trusting of people. In 10 years, I've worked hard to be less shy and put myself out there more. I'm still working on it, but I've come pretty far. That's very interesting. Okay, so next up, we have a very interesting speaker. When I first moved to Seneca Falls, I wanted to meet friends, so I joined Chorus. Because that's what you do. And I've been in a lot of choruses through my life, and the choir director in this one is a lady named Susan. And Susan was the first lady I ever had. She referred to a musical phrase as crunchy. And the whole thing is, it was. Like, it was a perfect term for it. And she makes it a lot more fun than some of the previous choirs I've been in. And I actually think she's very interesting, and she's very impressive. She's actually a doctor. And she actually came by way of doctor later in her life, which I also think is kind of really cool. So I asked her to come speak. So we're going to have Susan Cressman Avery, who is a doctor professor of music at Ithaca College.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Is it still on? Okay. And this is good to use?
Mm-hmm.
You can get that. Okay, great. 5-4, this is coming down. Inside there. Thank you. I'm very glad to know that you know, that the crunchy makes sense to somebody else other than me. Because, crunchy? Inside there. Good. Good. When Sarah asked me, and I think this is how we're all going to start, is when Sarah asked me, I was going, maybe. No. Luke, you said it nicely, and so I thank you for that. But for some reason, all of a sudden, it made sense too. One of the big things that I'm doing at this, what do you learn at the end of this decade? I didn't really think about it in the terms of a decade stop, but at a phrase break or at a time that it's time to sit back and say, you know, what else? What's different? And so I said yes, and I'll tell you some of the things that brought me to this that part of it. I had a pretty unremarkable childhood. Okay, I was very lucky. I think what made the biggest difference is that when I was 4 years old, my grandfather gave my mother a piano for her birthday. I was 4. My older sister was 9. We both started taking lessons. Okay, Marie doesn't play anymore, but it kind of resonated with me, and I've kept with this music thing. But you know, moving through it, I again was lucky for several different other reasons, and felt pretty good about the world of education. I felt pretty comfortable with it, and somehow with that converged with music, and I knew probably by my junior high years that I wanted to be a music teacher, okay? And sure enough, again, I'm kind of going quickly through those formative years, and ended up going. I'm from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Any other Pennsylvanians in the... Okay, good. Okay, yay, Allentown, right? Inside there. And so I was thrilled that I got accepted to Eastman in Rochester, and that's where I did my undergrad, and very sweetly met somebody very special on that first day of college, who's sitting back there. That's Doug. Anyway, yeah, that was years ago. Yeah, no, Armin, no, it's inside there. So, what? Fast forward through all this. A teaching career. I taught all of my public school career right down the road for 20 years at Waterloo High School, where I was the choral director, and I did the piano work for all the musicals, and I did vocal jazz, et cetera, et cetera. So 20 years in room 144. I must have written that as on my passes, you know, how many millions of times, so I'll remember my room number forever. But there was a time, and Sarah kind of alluded to it. So you're doing the math. Don't keep a track of how old. Okay, I am now. But all of a sudden, there was something that there was nagging at me, and I just needed to continue to develop. It was kind of like the phoenix kind of coming out of the ashes again. So I wanted to, both Doug and I did our master's degree, because we had to. But I wanted to keep going, and so it was in the early 90s when I decided to. And I was hoping to, and I did pursue it, and gained a doctorate, so a PhD in music education. And it was convenient, so I went to Eastman. It's one of those things that. I couldn't imagine, you know, going someplace else for it, and leaving, and just a phone call to Doug wasn't going to happen. So fast forwarding, what I feel unusual about in this situation is I really wish I had a dollar for every time that I gave a presentation at a state or a local or a national convention about curriculum, and there were all the other parts of teaching in music education, and I do have a lot under my belt, but I've always had it really prepared. So I really went out today, and I've got a couple things that I'm hanging my hat on tonight, but seriously, this is not a prepared PowerPoint. Okay, you can just feel with those that coming up and click, and that comes up. So what I'd like to do is, since this is my last year of teaching, I did 20. This is my 21st year at Ithaca College. Again, don't do the math. It's getting up there. So this is something that I really wanted to again be thinking about this cusp of a decade, not so much on the decades part, but a retirement, a real life change inside there. So I see myself as a teacher. I always will. I don't know me without it. And I'm a little scared to find out what happens when that does not happen. But one of the things that I've always loved is to steal good ideas. Okay, all teachers do. Warm-ups. Oh my God, when I hear a new warm-up, I am so thrilled when I get to hear it, because I am so bored with some of the warm-ups that I end up doing. So what I would do is I found a couple of, I was thinking about this, and I stole the ideas of some of the quotes that I loved, and I want to bring them to you tonight. I want to know if you like them too. Like them, I shouldn't say that. First of all, when Sarah said the theme of tonight is what I learned, I'm paraphrasing wildly, in the last decade, I looked up the word learn. Okay? You'd think I would know that by now, but what does it mean to learn something? But here's Webster's Dictionary. Okay, that's just why, because I didn't memorize all this stuff. Okay, to gain knowledge or understanding of or skill in by study, instruction, or experience. This is dripping down on me. Not very good at this. Techie blues. Slide there. Sorry. That way I'm gonna keep my hands on it. Doug. Sorry, he's always the technique person, the tech. Shit. Okay. Alright. Nonetheless, so what we're going to do, I want you to, again, thinking about what it means to learn. And it's not that I'm finished learning by any stretch of the imagination, but I wonder what some of these quotes mean to me. The first one I did that I loved is from, okay, wave at me if you like the movie, the book, of course, A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens. Got it. My favorite version of it is the Alistair Sim. I don't know if that... Okay. Oh! Good. Okay. There's been a lot. Patrick Stewart recently. The other one I can see him, but I can't think of it.
Albert Finney.
No, keep going on it, though.
Muppets.
I've got him. I've got Scrooge. I've got... George C. Scott. That's the one I was thinking of at this point. Okay. Inside there. But apparently, when I looked up this quote, because I wanted to get it right, I was watching it this afternoon, okay? It's never too early to get Alistair Sim out in my book, or you'll shoot your eye out, okay? I will watch that in June, okay? That's a different, nonetheless. Okay, you ready for this one? Do you know who says this? All right, you ready? This boy is ignorance, this girl is want. Beware them both and all of their degree. But most of all, beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased. Who said it?
My father-in-law.
Yeah. I hope he plays it. Go ahead, say it. You got it. The Ghost of Christmas Present. And you can see him opening the robe, and those two, you know, very, very emaciated children are there. This boy is ignorant. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both. But most of all, beware the boy. Okay. Ignorance. And again, please, all I would like to do is to just be salting things inside the air and saying, what might you think of when this is said? What is ignorance? And this is the most depressing quote, by the way. Okay? All right. So, you know, we go up from there. Okay. Inside there. But what I really want what that means to me inside there, and what it might mean to you as well. I'm also very interested in being the kind of storyteller I think of Garrison Keillor. Yes, Garrison Keillor?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Isn't he incredible to listen to? You want a storyteller? Get him. but nonetheless, inside there, what I would love some, not feedback from the audience in just the listening part, but if you have something inside there, what does the word ignorance mean to any of you? You don't have to raise your hand or nothing, because this is in school, okay? But it's ignorance. I say ignorance. What does that mean to you, Peter?
Choosing to live with your eyes closed.
Choosing to live with your eyes closed. Give me another one. Give me some ignorance.
Not knowing and not caring to know.
Not knowing and not caring to know.
Not
exposed. Say it again.
Not exposed.
Not exposed. Interesting. I'm learning more, and I really your idea of ignorance, and without being it, what I'd like you to do is to just keep, when you're thinking of that, think of somebody you know who is an ignorant person. Okay. Yeah, everybody's going. Who said it? I'm sorry. What was that? Yeah, inside there. So what does this, again, all these quotes will tie together, I promise you. But we're going to start with that seedlings. Beware ignorance inside there. And as you continue to use the word age in a very nice way, okay, because we've got people who are just starting that journey. And people who are a little further on in that journey, inside there. Ignorance is, they say ignorance is
bliss.
Yeah. Okay, I'm not so sure I agree, but maybe inside there I will change my mind as I continue the journey. But I'd like you to just keep this word right here. Okay, this ignorance inside there. And maybe the person that typifies it right next to it. Okay? Inside there. Ignorance. Is it local person? Is it somebody you interact with often? Or somebody you just see on television? Or that you inside like that? Ignorance. I'm gonna move to another quote. Again, this is all quotes that somehow have resonated to me, in me at this stage of my getting ready to dip my toe into retirement, which is coming quickly. Okay, here comes. Poetry and hums aren't things which you get. They're things which get you. And all you can do is to go where they can find you. Winnie the Pooh. Okay? Mm-hmm. Knowing and having my life in the arts and different strands of it and different kinds of it, it spoke to me. Poetry and homes, to me, is music. Whether it is just those two, but their arts is so much broader than that. I love it that you mentioned filmmaking, and you were at the Park School. Good for you. Okay, that is no mean feat there, okay, inside there. So that is special. Thank you for that and sharing that too. But what is it about the aesthetics that at this point you could have done without when you were younger, but now you realize it's one of those things that's kind of making that next day a little bit more beautiful? What is it about the crunchy phrase? Okay, what is it about the fact that Your the piano music that you're doing and what you are now singing. Sorry, I know my singers in the audience. Okay, careful. Can't hide from me inside there. What does it do? Once I wrote an article, 2 + 2 = 5, if you do it correctly. What is that aspect? What is it that the arts bring to you that the everyday, that elevates you? So we can love poetry and hums. Aren't things which you get, they're things which get you. And again, where do you find it? I'm going to do this because it's starting to drive me a little crazy. And all you can do is to go where they can find you. Please find a way to let those, whether it is visual, aural, whether it is kinesthetic, whatever the arts mean to you. I'm hoping that you're going to if you haven't really looked for them on a daily basis, see what you can find. Because if you can take the word poetry and hums out, words out, and put the word beauty inside there, sometimes there's not enough of that inside there. And what you think is beauty and beautiful really counts. Okay? It may not be my idea of beauty, but that's okay too. That's all right. So boy is ignorance, and there's poetry and hums. Here's a quote that I'm understanding differently as I increase in age. Okay, now this one I didn't ask, but I think that you did recognize that it was Winnie the Pooh, which was kind of interesting. I would not have guessed Winnie the Pooh. Okay. This one, I don't know if anybody would get in it. That's not the game. But listen to this one again, what it might be teaching me, and maybe if it helps you, you know, as you're not falling asleep at 2 a.m. Anybody? Yeah, welcome to that club. Yes, okay. And here it is. Learn how to see. Realize that everything connects to everything else. Gotta say that one again. I'm going to change it, and it's okay. I'm gonna, if you'll forgive me for altering something, okay, inside there. But the original speaker is dead, so he can't say much about me. Okay. Learn how to see. Realize that everyone connects to everyone else. The original is everything connects to everything else. I was speaking to my friend before this, and we have many thoughts in common, and they came out kind of quickly. One of the people that I really, and this is not the person that said it, but one of the persons that I always wished that I would have met is Carl Sagan, okay? And he was down the road, for God's sakes, okay? Oh, geez, inside there. He once said, if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you have to invent the universe from scratch. What are we talking? And then I read also, this was yesterday, that you are a few billion atoms that have come together right now to make you. Don't worry, they'll make something else when you're gone. Inside there. Learn how to see. Realize that everything connects to everything else. I can almost see a child's game coming out of that. But I'm wondering about the flip over. Oh, by the way, that's Leonardo da Vinci.
I was right.
Really? Oh, my God. gosh. This is, wow, I am speaking. This is pretty amazing. You would put that together with such a thinker from those years ago inside there. Knowing that that's here's the original words, that just if I can just flip things just a little bit and say that everyone is connected to everyone else, that we share, we are, as my friend said, we are star stuff. Okay? And it just takes a little bit different. And he had to remind me it was Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Okay? We are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. Yeah, Joni Mitchell wrote it. Okay, so everyone connects to everyone else, that it matters to me that you exist. Whatever that you is, I'm starting to understand that real differently now. And if you aren't there yet, that you know, just keep this rolling around inside there. If you like the quote, if not, flush it. You don't have to, you know. There's not going to be a test, okay? I've done enough of those inside. Okay. Here's one. Everybody's going to get this one. Who said? There's no place like home. Dorothy! That's right. That's right. Inside there. My question is, what's home to you? What do you mean? I mean, is it the building? Is there something else? What is this thing called home? And what is it really, what is it representing to you? Because for a lot of the students that I have met in my 40 years of teaching, the word home is a scary place. Okay? And who's home? And where that home is tonight, or whatever. But putting that aside, taking the word home and kind of letting it be, what is it mean to you when you say, there's no place like it. There's no place like it. Is it a state of mind? Is it something that you're creating? And have you taken the time, not, you know, they say to smell the roses, but to really think about what that is to you? And it's pretty amazing. I have one quote left, but at this point, I just would like to almost say, quotes again, pulling it through, what music that I'm taking it back to, all of a sudden, where'd you get that all of a sudden come in from? What it does for you. The Greeks had it. Okay? I'm also lucky enough to teach in the grad program, so I teach our master's students. And the Greeks really kind of had their thumb on it, that it's important for the mind. Okay? It's important for the body. No matter what kind of music, whether it's the performance of the body itself or that. And it's important for the soul, the expression. Whatever you want to call heart is all about. And they understood that. They had different scales, and they wanted, they knew that scale and that scale created, or they thought, that kind of child or whatever. And so they would hire tutors, that music was played for their young ones, etc. They really believed in the power of what there is. Now, whether we do or not inside there, but what I'd like you to be thinking about is, as you are, again, coming up, you know, to a new decade, perhaps, if there is no music in your life, first of all, well, I'd love to... Can I do a commercial? okay. Wave your hand if you're in Seneca Singers. Come on, fellas, put it up. Okay, inside there. Okay, good. Okay, and they do get extra credit for coming there. Damn, I can't stop talking like a teacher inside there. Then find your own music. Okay, you gotta find it. It is more than just, I got a coupon for Italian bread. Okay, there's something more to it. What is this thing that capital M music might be? Okay, there. So that's my hope for you tonight. If any of the quotes make sense, here is my last one. Keep your eyes open and look in unexpected places for surprises that can change things as small as the moment or as large as your life. You'll have no idea who said it because I put it together. What I'd like you to do is to realize there are surprises everywhere. Three of you, I'd like everybody to, I'd like you to check underneath your chairs. Mm-hmm. Underneath the seat. Underneath the actual seat of it. Okay. Now, right. Now you're ripping part of the chairs. I don't know what the hell you're doing. Okay. There are three. Armin. Heather. Yeah. And so does Deb. It is something. I did this. I was invited to be a speaker at graduation at Ithaca College, at the master's degree, several Decembers ago when they graduate and send that. And I had Christmas DVDs taped underneath some of the seats because I quoted something from each one of that. What you got was just a little thing, is you'd never think of looking there. I need to tell you that if it weren't for the fact, on September 13th, 1972, I looked across a wooden table, saw someone, and he's my husband now. The surprises are amazing. If you did not look, you'd never know. And sometimes you have to, people will tell you to look, but sometimes you might say, look what's there, inside there. So if you will, don't forget to look in surprises in places you'd never expect to. Because you know what? You'd be amazed at what's going to be sometimes there. Sometimes it's a coupon for an Italian bread. Sometimes it's something even more precious. Thanks.
Don't you wish she was your music teacher?
Yes.
I certainly do. I mean, I'd be a better musician now. But I hear what she's saying. Like, I was death marched to music lessons my entire life. I should be really good, and I never worked my way above mediocre. But coming into music myself as a grown-up and choosing it, I'm really glad I have it. And it's...
And I'm glad you're with us.
Whether you're good or not, it's just nice to have. And to some degree, what you're saying is music is a lot like storytelling. In a way, you're sharing a story with someone, and everything that's different about you in that room, like, we're in that chorus room, like, I don't want to know what that guy across the room thinks about, like, abortion. Like, I don't care. I don't know who he voted for in presidency. I don't know where he stands on the impeachment. Does not matter. It's about the harmony. And it's kind of nice that you have that moment that you're sharing, you're telling a story together. And that's what music means to me. I'm glad I have it. Okay. How are you a different person now than you were 10 years ago, 20 years? More relaxed, less worried about what people think, and a more mellow. I hope to get more mellow. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm not a mellow person. No. Like, Alyssa's always saying, like, you need to meditate and clear your mind. And, like, I spend a lot of time and money filling this up. Like, I need this. 10 years ago, I was less confident but more extroverted. 20 years ago, I was just learning how to be confident and even more extroverted. Stronger, more weak, more emotionally aware, but less capable of organizing my emotions. More aware and in touch with my surroundings, while more confident as to how to cope with them. How are you a different person? Retirement, service to my community, more aware, and frustrated with the political and cultural extremism. I hear you, sister. Okay, next up, we have another speaker. I met Pete because I was in a play with his wife, and I liked his wife, so I figured if she's willing to stay married to him, he can't be all that bad. And the thing about Pete is he seems to pop up a lot of places that I want to be and do the things that I want to do. So if he's going to be there anyway, I might as well just get to know him. And I have, and he's actually pretty cool. Pete is also a professor. He was a professor of astronomy at FLCC. I believe you're retired now?
Yes.
But now he's just a man about town doing cool stuff. Which is a great thing to be. That's my dream job. So Pete Saraceno, take the stage.
I'm going to have to take a minute to get situated here because, like a teacher, I have books and I have notes and I have a guitar.
So I'm
going to
have to figure out how to navigate
all this while being able to be heard and using my cheat sheet. Let's see. So I'm going to just take a minute here. Maybe this will work. It's nice. If you've ever done theater, it's so wonderful to have props. Sometimes they just solidify your character. I was in a play that Doug directed years ago, and Sue was a musical director, Fiddler on the Roof, and I was the guy I never wanted to be. He was the Russian guy who kicked everybody out of town, you know, the bad guy. And you learn the lines, and then you're starting to learn to breathe life into the lines, and then you have to make the guy come alive, whether you like him or not. That's acting. And somebody, John King, another local actor, just looked at me one night and said, "You know what you need? You need a little stogie." I forget, you know, those Italian cigars that are like a stick. I see, and so I tried it, and it just grabbed the character for me, and it just solidified it. It helped me get it. So this is going to be like a prop. But anyways, just like, can you hear me okay? Should I get this closer? Okay. Susan, just bring the stand closer. I think I can. Yeah. That's good. Okay. Okay. So, I have my cheat sheet here just in terms of keeping me on track about the points I want to make. And the first thing, like everybody else, is the introduction and how I got roped into this, okay? Yours truly over there said, you know, hey, we're going to have a story. I love storytelling. I really do. Being Italian, you can't stop talking, you know? Did you ever hear the story of the Italian with the speech impediment? He had one hand tied behind his back. That's me. But, you know, you never have the opportunity. And she said, you know, this is what, and I said, geez, I like the idea. What's the topic? And she said, what you've learned from the last decade. And I went, oh, geez, you know. And so I was kind of begging off. And she said, well, it can be any decade, you know. And I started thinking, I said, well, you know, what would that be for me? And I said, well, the one that immediately came to mind were the 60s. It was very traumatic for me and enlightening and inspiring in a lot of different ways. I mean, John Kennedy was murdered, Bobby Kennedy was murdered, Dr. King was murdered, and the Beatles saved my life. I mean, they really just helped us kids. We were kids at the time, and through all that trauma and tragedy, this new thing that was just, I'll never stop thinking before. So I said, well, geez, you know, maybe I could do the 60s. And then I said, and then so we went back and forth, and I was on the verge of saying no. And she said, well, you know, given your age, you're about 300, you know. She said, why don't you just, you know, tell your younger self what your older self has learned from having lived. And I said, you know, well, I got to thinking about it. I said, well, that's something I'm comfortable with and I could probably do justice to, but what would I tell my younger self? Now, this is going to kind of give my talk away because my talk has something to do with contemplative prayer. And so I'm driving down the road, and this happens. You'll find out if you ever try this. I'm driving down the road, I'm saying, what the heck, you know, what the heck would I talk about? And all of a sudden, I didn't hear a voice or anything like that, but there was this little intuition that said, tell them about me. I went, ah! I didn't hear that. No. And I wasn't going to do it. And then I just, you know, sense it again. Tell them about me. So I finally just said, you know, a lot of this you're going to hear is really, a lot of times there's leaps of faith in the life of coming to know what I'm going to term the mystery with a capital M. So I said, what the hell, you know, what the hell you got to do? So this whole talk is me jumping off a cliff, kind of. So I'm going to begin with that. And this, I'm stealing a little bit from Leonard Cohen here. Remember the song, Suzanne? This is just a little section of it. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men shall be sailors then until the sea shall free them. Men shall be sailors then until the sea shall free them. As Carl Sagan used to love to say after he would think of something, curious. He loved to say that. I love that about him. So I'm going to give a talk to my younger self, okay? This isn't to you. It's to my younger self as me now as a 39-year-old man. Plus squared. But it's to my younger self. You guys are essentially eavesdroppers in on a conversation, okay? It doesn't mean you can't, if something I say resonates with you, by all means, go for it. I'm not here to proselytize, to convince, to argue, to prove. I'm just telling a story to my younger self from what I've learned. And there may be times when I just stop and ask you to consider something that I've said, though, just, you know, just to keep you awake. And so, Sarah won't think I'm too boring. Okay, so, and I'll get into the conversation with my younger self in a second, but suffice it to say, you know, in a couple of weeks here, we're going to be celebrating It's a Wonderful Life weekend and George Bailey and the bridge and stuff. And suffice it to say, without getting into particulars, the complexities of life can happen to you. I'm sure they probably happened to you. They certainly happened to me in my younger life. And I found myself kind of like in the same situation as George. You know, the bottom had fallen out. You know, the Christian author C.S. Lewis. It's just going to keep falling over here.
Problem solved.
Thank you very much. Check, can you hear that? Is that on? Okay. So if you know the author, C.S. Lewis, a Christian author, he when he was very young, his mom died. It was a great tragedy, great trauma for him. And the way he described the emotional impact on it, I'll never forget, he said, the great continent had sunk. It was all seas and islands now. The great continent, kind of like George felt on the bridge, okay? The foundation is gone. There's nothing. Bob Dylan put, you know, like a rolling stone with no direction home. So there was a point in time, without getting into particulars, I found myself in that situation. Basically being a person of good heart, trying everything and nothing seemed to work. And I was really, you know, feeling a lot like George and maybe C.S. Lewis. And I finally said to myself, you know, you've tried everything else. Nothing else seems to work. The only thing left, and if it doesn't work, essentially you're screwed, is try your faith again, you know. And and I said, you know, what the heck do I got to lose? So the journey begins, and now you're going to be in on the conversation, okay? So I'm there with my younger self, and now I'm talking to him and saying, you know, we've tried everything. You got nothing to lose. You know, we do have the faith we were raised in. You might, you know, a lot of people talk about them. You know, you don't know how true it is, but, you know, you might want to try Jesus. So now I'm going to stop and just to you, and I don't want an answer from you, but I want you, that can be a very loaded word. God can be a very loaded word. So I want you just to stop and consider what they might bring up in your own, how they might resonate with you, positively or negatively. You know, what would a Muslim person think of when they heard that word? What would a mother who just lost a child think? What would a person who just lost a home in a natural disaster think? What would a Jewish person think? What would an evangelical Christian think? It's loaded. You could ask six different people in a pew on any church on Sunday, and it'd probably bring up different things in them. And so now I'm telling myself, and I know based on your upbringing, that brings up things in you. The way you were raised, you were raised a pre-Vatican II Catholic, and man, oh man, God the Father was an angry judge, very vindictive, he didn't do half the things he wanted you to do. And then you get to Jesus, and he was kind of like God the Father who took an anger management course, you know. And if you were raised Catholic, you would know that the only person who was really safe to go to was Mary. She was the one who really, you know, I can take your part, I can go to him for you, and, you know, and have your back. So I know you have a lot of baggage. Also, part of the complexities of life. You've had some pretty negative experiences at the hands of people who profess to be followers of it, which really exacerbates things. But again, let's just give it a try. What do we got to lose? We have nothing left. It might work out for us. What do you think? All right, let's go. Now, I'm going to warn you, little guy, there's going to be some requirements. I'm talking here through the eyes of age, at 67 years old. There's going to be some challenges here along the way, right? One is, what is God like? You know, everybody says, believe in God, believe in God. So what is a God you want to believe in like? There's a wonderful little section at the beginning of the book of Job. At the beginning of the book of Job, Job is called the most godly man on the face of the earth. And then life gives them the 1-2 punch, throws a kitchen sink at him. He is devastated. He doesn't know what the hell's going on. And toward the end of the book, he actually has an encounter with the divine. And essentially says, I've heard a lot about you, but now I encounter you. And I got a lot of re-imaging to do, both of you and of myself, now that I encountered you. The most godly man on the face of the earth was only just beginning to know the divine. And it is true, young man, of all of us, okay? So first thing that's going to be required if you decide to go this route is it's going to take time. Just like any human relationship, you're going to need time, waste time getting to know this person with a capital P. You guys may have heard a lot about Pete Saraceno. Now you're meeting him and you get a better sense of him because you know him. And it's going to have to happen, okay? Another thing you have to expect probably till the day you die, there's always going to be tension between the God you were taught and the mystery you were taught and the mystery you are encountering. Always going to be a struggle because the image of God you were taught is really, really punitive, very judgmental, very the little least thing you do. It's written in the book and you're screwed. I know my father died in his 90s terrified because of the type of God he had been taught. And it's going to be this tension between the God you were taught and the God you were encountering, if you take the time to know the God, that God. Because the God you were taught is so incredibly, the God you're going to meet is so incredibly different than the God you were taught. Just be aware of that, okay? Third thing is there's going to be a lot of challenge. There's going to be ways you're going to be challenged to grow, you know? It's kind of like when you learn to type up at Minders there. We were typing with one finger. Mrs. Smith taught us how to finally type, and it was a big adjustment. And you were a lot better once you learned it, but going from one to the other was, you know. Or learning, you know, you get out of the womb and you finally learn to crawl, and this crawling's a really, really cool thing. It's a really good thing. And somebody says, well, now it's time to walk. And you go, you know. But once you walk, the freedom you get from walking is a lot. It beats the heck out of crawling, but that transition can be very, very scary. And that's going to happen to you, too. But take the leap of faith. Let's go. We got nothing else to lose. And I think what you'll find if you stick with it is you are going to find yourself on a journey into what I'm going to call an incredible mystery. Now, I want to pause again and ask you folks, what exactly comes to mind when you hear that word mystery? You don't have to answer, but somebody, you know, woke you up 2 in the morning, shined a flashlight in your eyes and said, mystery. What would think about that for a second. Yeah, what I want to tell you, little boy, is a lot of people kind of have a definition of mystery is something that you can never know about. God, it's a mystery to me. I don't know. But what you're going to find, I think, if you commit yourself to this journey, is a mystery that is endlessly knowable. It isn't that it's unknowable. Can't exhaust what there is to know about it. And like our friend Job, forever you are going to be slowly learning. And I assume to the day you die and afterwards, it'll take eternity to understand eternal mind, eternity to understand eternal heart, eternity to understand eternal love. So just get yourself ready for that. Okay? So here we go. The first place you're going to have to look is in creation. Now, I am a science teacher. I teach earth science, astronomy, and meteorology. I just retired a few years ago from Marcus Whitman. I'm an adjunct at Finger Lakes Community College. Let me get my bearings here. Yeah, there's a story. It's attributed to the Sufi mystics, but also to King David when he asked the divine, you know, why did you create the cosmos? And the divine's answer is, I was a treasure wanting to be known, so I created the cosmos so I could be known. So the offshoot of that is, you can begin to get a sense of what the mystery is with a capital M in creation and what the mystery is made. When I used to teach at St. Pat's years ago, I have a good friend, a local potter, John Simolo. Some of you might know him. He makes incredible pottery. And I would have a cup of his, and I would say to the kids, you know, just trying to get them interested in religion, you know, middle school kids, you know, they look at your religion. What the? And I'd say, this is a friend of mine made this, Jan Pat, Jan Similar made this, Pat. Tell me three things you can know about him. You've never met him. And tell me three things you can know about him just by looking at the Pat he made. And we would approach it that way. And that's what this is, okay? If, in fact, the story science tells about creation, I'm an astronomy teacher, 13.8 billion years ago, there was an unfolding. And tremendous heat slowly cooled and formed the first matter. And that was hydrogen and helium. And hydrogen and helium collected into these things called stars. And stars collected into groups called galaxies. And in the hearts of those stars was made the elements we all studied in chemistry in the periodic table. And they fused new elements all through their lives, and then they died, incredibly long spans of time. The second generation stars fused even heavier elements, so you could finally get planets. And the third generation stars, like our suns, had enough heavier elements built by then. The lighter elements are constantly making the heavier elements that you could get people. That's the story science tells. That can profoundly inform, I'm telling this to myself here, that can profoundly inform spirituality. Okay, because if there is a creator, we're back to something Susan was talking about. If we posit that there is a creator that created this, and this is part of the mystery, Einstein said energy and matter are two sides of the same coin. Theology would say spirit and matter are two sides of the same coin. Spirit is hiding in matter. Everything is, how can I say this? Everything is a word of God. Everything is God expressing, the infinite expressing itself in finite form. So the cosmos, this incredible cosmos that science talks of, is literally the body of God. It's God expressing itself in material form. This is the realm of form and not spirit. So the two, you can begin to see a picture of this thing I'm calling the mystery in creation itself. In which you see, again, touching on what Susan said, is a cosmos. Carl Sagan said cosmos is the Greek term for the ordered whole. Interconnected, interlocking, interdependent whole. And what kind of insight can that give you into the mystery? And this mystery, spirit hiding in matter. This is every plant, every bird, every insect, every blade of grass, every person is literally God expressing itself in a different way. You, me, everybody. So that's where I want you to begin. Now, so far so good, but, you know, a lot of people rightly say that, you know, you're talking about a being that can create all these this universe, and science has a lot of different universes. How do you get your mind around that? You know, how do you grasp that, which is too difficult to grasp. Sorry, I can't get that word. But how do you do that? You know, there's a saying, the Tao that can be known is not the Tao. Once you think you got it, it's just too big and it's beyond your grasp. But that's really hard to get your arms around. Plus, when life throws stuff at you, like we've been talking about, these complexities, it's really hard to love an abstraction. You know, if your child dies, if your house blows down in a tornado, if you're diagnosed with cancer, et cetera, all the stuff in life, you need something more than an abstraction. I'm telling this to my little boy here. And now enters what I feel is the genius of Christianity, okay? The genius of Christianity is Jesus, Jesus the Christ. And why? Again, it's a loaded word, but bear with me for a little bit. The genius of Christianity is Jesus gives the mystery a face. Jesus gives the mystery something you can touch, feel, talk to, cry with, walk with, be afraid with, you name it. You have something. You have the human need met to have access to the mystery. There's a beautiful passage in the Gospel of John at the Last Supper, and Jesus is going on and on. I'm in the Father is in me, and Philip, one of his disciples, gets really exasperated and says, "Show us the Father, and it's enough." And Jesus, probably really frustrated, says, "How long have I been with you, and you don't know me? He who has seen me has seen the Father." So in the face of Jesus, we're seeing the mystery. In creation, you see the mystery revealed in matter. In Jesus, you see the mystery revealed in the face of a person you can touch and feel and talk to and cry with and be afraid with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Navigate the complexities of life with. So that's a good start. Now, getting toward the end here. Okay, so the first place we're going to know them, I mean, your scriptures, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you can take a look at them, but when you look at them, your suffering that you've been through is actually going to be for your benefit because it can help you look at those stories through the lens of suffering, through the lens of have-nots. And I believe they were all written for and through the hands of have-nots. So let's take a look at his life. Born poor, fleeing for his life from a bloodthirsty dictator into a country he knows nothing about, knows the language, literally him and his family fleeing for his life. Comes back, most of his adult life he doesn't have a home. At the apex of his career, he's abandoned and forsaken by the people he trusts the most. He is betrayed by a dear friend. He is stripped naked and tortured and murdered by his own religious leaders, the leaders of the faith community, leaders of the government, thrown out of the faith community, buried in a borrowed grave, and on and on and on and on. Eats with lepers, eats with the downtrodden, friend of the friendless. It's a brand new image of him. You know, we put him on a pedestal for all the wrong reasons. He is the ultimate have-not. So he could relate to the have-nots of any variety. And listen to the calculus he uses to even get into heaven. I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was in prison and you visited me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because just like any parent will be able to relate to this, what you do to the very least, the very, very least, the most downtrodden, the most insignificant, the person you wouldn't look twice at, you do to me. So, and he refers himself so many times in the Gospels as a son of man, and I've always thought that is means he's right in the shit with us. You know, we put him on a pedestal for the wrong reason. He came in boot camp, he suffered the worst. I'm sure they met, in that whole passion at the end, I'm convinced they made him wish he was never born. And that Jesus' word is so loaded. Can you think of a Jesus who wished he was never born because they made him feel so humiliated? One with, you know, in a few months, a few weeks, we're going to celebrate Advent, which is Emmanuel, that song, O Come Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us, the mystery with us. But it's a mystery. The bottom line for Jesus' life is self-giving love. Is that what the mystery is like? Self-giving love. So you can learn some of that if you look, you know, through the eyes of that, through the correct lens in Scripture. And now I want to encourage you as you go through, you're going to need to, like Job, you're going to need to encounter the mystery too, and that's what contemplative prayer is all about. It's a time where you decide you're going to get by yourself each day a little bit and devote time to getting to know this mystery personally. The mystics like to say, love is always offered, it's never demanded, never required, it's always offered, it's like a radio signal, always going out. You can turn the radio on and put yourself in a position to receive it or not. In what a lot of people, myself included, think contemplative prayer is all about is developing a practice where you can put yourself in a position where you offer the least resistance to that. So we're going to do that. And you're going to find, again, I'm talking to my boy here, if you are faithful to that, what you're going to find is some really, really beautiful things. Remember that tension. There's always going to be, this can't be true. I mean, you know, one way you're kind of ducking because of the guy you were taught, and yet the mystery you are encountering is, I have a whole long list, but I'm not going to read it, but it's the very first thing that strikes me is just how humble, just how humble. Humble, no services beneath him, just humble, loving, understanding, kind, patient, protective, funnier than hell, a wicked sense of humor, and on it goes. And one of the things, I want to make sure I get this, I guess the bottom line is, what you're going to encounter is a friend for all time, and someone who is capable of giving you anything you've ever missed. If you need a mother, if you need a father, if you need a brother, if you need an uncle, if you need a friend, if you need a home, we're talking home, if you need anything you need, he's capable of giving, whatever needs you have. To really find if that's true, you'd have to come and see, but that's what I'm encouraging you to do. One really, really, really cool thing, too, is as time goes on, you are going to encounter a silence. And I got to read this because I never remembered it, but a silence that reveals itself as a refuge, an awareness that can be trusted, tenderly loving, and resounding with the majesty and mystery of the sacred. And the mystery slowly turns out to be holy, unconditional, self-giving love. Let me repeat that. Holy, unconditional, self-giving love. I wonder how many of us have ever thought of the divine as holy, unconditional, self-giving love. In all the ways we have, you know, even in today's political climate, all the ways we see power used, all the ways we've experienced power being used in our lives. You know, imagine the mystery appearing in person and saying, let me wash your feet. You know, what really happened according to the Gospels? He went to Peter and said, you're not going to wash my feet. So that's what you experience. What you're going to feel like over time as you are faithful to this, and there's going to be a lot of ups and downs, two steps forward, three steps back, a lot of tension between the God you were taught and this mystery you're encountering is just some words I wrote. Honored, loved, cherished, home, belonging, a friend for all time, and a growing sense of, the only thing I can call this is oneing. And it's harder in hell to describe, and I guess without experience it, you probably, I don't have a good definition for it, but it's a situation when you're in a relationship with a person where you're not one, but you're not two either. It's the only thing I can say about it. And last but not least, little by little, to your amazement, you're finding that you, little by little, you're looking at life through someone else's eyes. You're looking at, you actually, and I think this profoundly really increases when you die, I think, but you're looking at life through someone else's eyes, with someone else's heart, with someone else's ears. You're actually beginning, you find yourself looking at life, and it's almost like God is looking through you. And it's a look of love, and it's a look of compassion. And most importantly, you begin to look at your own self through those eyes. You have the tender-hearted love, you have the tender heart of Christ looking at yourself with all your imperfections and all your imperfections. Last but not least, so my little boy might say to me, oh, yeah, okay, now, I hate to use this word, you guys, but what's the quid pro quo? You know, this sounds pretty good, but like everything else, if it's that good, it's too good to be true. What's this for that? What's a quid pro quo? And the good news is it is absolutely free. It is. That's what unconditional means. There is no duty in response to being loved. Absolutely none. You know, I might love my dog 20%, my cat 30%, my mailman 60%. It's something I have. Where this mystery, love is something it is. Think about that. Its very nature is love. So it is unconditional. Now that being said, young man, you might find yourself compelled to respond in love. Because, you know, it might draw it out of you. There's a book I read and the mystic said that Jesus said to them, you know, conversion is only, what man calls conversion is only the discovery of the great friend. And what man calls religion is the knowledge of the great friend. And what man calls holiness is the imitation of the great friend. So you might be called, like Jesus himself was called, to go out and give people an impression of what the mystery is like. And I think the mystery really gets off in it. I'm fond of telling people, you know, the wine doesn't get changed to water until someone fills a pot. All these people say, you know, with gun violence or whatever, I'll pray for it. Yeah, I'll pray for it. Yeah, I'll pray. Now, prayer is fine. I think prayer is really powerful, but the water doesn't get changed to wine until somebody fills the pots. And the bread, the loaves and fishes don't get handed out, don't get multiplied until somebody hands them out. And the fishermen find the nets overflowing with fish until they throw the nets into the lake. So there's effort required on our part. And there's a lot to be done, and I'm sure the mystery would like a lot of help, any help. I'm going to close with a poem that kind of sums this up for me. It's a German poet. Susan and I were trying to decide, neither of us really knew if it was a male or female, because the name is Rainer Maria Rilke. I don't know if you ever heard that poet. He says, you know, because we thought Maria must be a girl, right? And it's a guy. This is a book, book of poems, Book of Hours, Love Poems to God. It's a real short poem. It doesn't even have a title, or if it does, it's in German and I can't read it. But God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your recall, go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like flame, and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is a country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. Thanks.
I'm also getting like a theme here that I'm a very convincing person, apparently.
No,
like,
bully.
Yeah, it threatened. It threatened, but it works. I'm gonna finish these up. Okay, 10 years ago, I was not a grandmother. Now I have 4, soon to be 5 grandbabies. 20 years ago, I was much thinner and healthier. Children and cancer, everything changes. Let's see. I'm more into myself, comfortable being me, than 17-year-old me or 27-year-old me. I'm more in love with who I am, just more achy. I've accepted me for me, and it makes life a lot easier. Okay, next up we have Caitlin Canto. I first met her because she was one of my favorite actresses at Brestavella Theater, and she would come and perform. And then she moved here to become the associate director of Brestavella Theater, and she's really spunky. And, like, I know she can handle a stage because I saw her on stage before I saw her do anything else. And also, she loves dinosaurs almost as much as I do. So that makes her even cooler. Okay, so Caitlin Canto.
I just brought my drink up because I have a throat thing. I promise I'm not sick. Sometimes my throat just freaks out. So yeah, I'm Caitlin. When Sarah asked me to do this, I was like, she sent me a Facebook message, and I was like, hi, I'm on vacation in California. Can I get right back to you? And she's like, yeah, sure. And then 2 days later, I was still in California. She's like, can you do this thing? And I was like, oh, it's just talking? Sure. Yeah. My mom likes to say that I started talking at 9 months and never stopped. So yeah, I'm the Associate Artistic Director of Bristol Valley Theatre in Naples. Subscriptions now on sale. But I, like many artsy people, I have had a lot of day jobs. This is actually, I am a very rare bird in that I work full-time in a theatre and that I have health insurance and a salary that, like, almost never happens. So, woohoo! Yay me! So I'm 32, so 10 years ago, the beginning of this decade, I had just graduated from college. I got a double major in theater arts and communications and rhetoric from Nazareth College, which means that I learned to play pretend and write real good, and then I got a bunch of student loans for it. It was great. I loved it. It was great. I loved college. And then I packed up and moved to New York to do the thing. I was like, oh man, I'm 22. I'm awesome. I'm going to move to New York and be an actor the whole time. It's going to be great. So I have, over the past 10 years, there's been lots of ways that I've made money. I have made money as an actor, as a singer, as a stage manager. That's like a person who like bosses everyone around for the director. A fight choreographer. I like to throw fake punches on stage. That's really fun. I've been an acting teacher, and now I am in a full-time administrative job where I do all of that. But in addition to all of that, like many artsy people, I've had lots of day jobs, some kind of normal, some kind of not. So, you know, I've been a barista, a server, a bartender, a piercer at a tattoo studio, a administrative assistant, a box office associate, and a wedding planner. So I've done a bunch of different things to make money. And something that I have found over these past 10 years of adult employment is one of my least favorite phrases, and I am very guilty of saying this as well, is, you know what you should do? You should just... No matter what job I have had, people feel very comfortable saying this phrase to me and informing me of how I should do that job better or how I'm just trying far too hard and they have a really easy solution for it. The only outlier to that is the piercing job. Usually people don't tell you how to do your job when you're coming at them with a pointy thing. But I did get lots of weird comments because I was actually less tattooed and less pierced than I am now when I was a piercer. I had a couple less ear holes, and I had zero dinosaur tattoos. Now I have two. The main advice that I got when I had that job was, you know what you should do? Get more tattoos. And I'd be like, well, I mean, I like tattoos. Don't get me wrong. I'm an actor, so I have to, you know, wear costumes and stuff. And they're like, yeah, but you look weird piercing people with not a bunch of piercings in your face. And I'm like, okay, well, no. but when I was a server and a barista, a lot of the you know what you should do's were kind of more generalized customer service-y type things. Like, you know what you should do? Give us a round of shots. And you know what you should do? Just put a little bit more alcohol in there. Do you know what you should do? Just like 3 extra shots of espresso. And so those things are like annoying because there's actual reasons, right? Why I can't do that. Because my boss actually, you know, keeps track of the liquor, so I can't just pour you a double shot. I can't just give you extra espresso, same reason. I can't just have the exact coffee that you want brewed at all hours of the day because you only come in once every 4 weeks. So those ones aren't as annoying. However, when you are a server in New York City and you are a youngish person, people assume that you're an actor. In my case, that was correct. But they assume you're some sort of actor, artist. So a lot of these conversations go, so are you an actor? I am. Are you on Broadway? It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday, so no, I'm not currently on Broadway. I'm serving you beers. My husband actually has the very best example of this, so I'm going to steal this story from him. But similar story, he's working in a restaurant. Someone asks, are you an actor? Yes. And they say, you know what you should do? A movie with De Niro. Like, oh my God, you're so right. I will call up Robert De Niro because he is on my speed dial, and I will mention to him that we should do a movie together. Obviously, there are lots of reasons that I wasn't on Broadway at the time or not in a movie at the time. One, I wasn't in a movie at the time because I've never been in a movie, and I'm too big and theatrical for film. I look ridiculous when you put a camera on me. For stage, I'm great because I'm, like, really big and stuff. But people don't, you know, a lot of people don't know the difference between that, and that's fine. You know, people don't need to know the difference between acting styles, but God, they love to give you advice about it. Another thing you see, though, like, oh, you're an actor? Cry. Cry right now. Like, I'm literally at work, and I have, like, 6 tables, but sure, I'll just cry because that's what I want to do. So those ones are kind of annoying. And then, you know, I was a wedding planner for a couple years. That was actually really fun. I love weddings. I've always loved weddings. I'm a big romantic, and ironically enough, I had a 2-year-long engagement before my own wedding, and that's the 2 years that I was a wedding planner. So along with planning our wedding, I also planned about 300 other weddings. In addition to being a planner, so I worked for I called it a wedding factory. It was a big catering company that owned like 8 different venues, and so a bride would sign on, they would get hand it off to me, I would be like, great, what color are your tablecloths? This is perfect. Oh, yay, it's going to be the best day of your life. And then I would hand it off to their day of coordinator. I was also a day of coordinator. So sometimes I would have worked with the bride for the last year, year and a half, and answered about 4,000 of her emails. Or sometimes I didn't meet the bride until the day before the wedding, and they gave me a bunch of stuff and said, here, please make it the most beautiful day of my life. And I was happy to do so. So that one, most of the people that I run into aren't the, you know what you should do, you should just types. But of course they pop up. So most people are just like, please help me plan this wedding. I don't want to do all of it. And some people are like, I want sparklers. And I'm like, sparklers are great. Love a sparkler exit. You have a brunch wedding, taking place at 11 o'clock in the morning. So, your pictures aren't going to turn out that well. And they're like, can't you just do something about that? I don't know, you wanted the cheaper time slot, and I can't make it dark, I'm very sorry. I literally, actually, when I was coordinating a wedding once, someone's elderly maiden aunt came up to me and asked me what I planned to do about the rain. We're gonna get married, they're gonna get married in the sunset. No, that was not their plan. They were planning to get married in the meadow. Yeah, it's raining. Well, what are you going to do about it? Well, I sent God a fax, but he didn't get it. And she didn't find that funny. So sometimes, you know, people are just like, well, why don't you just, and it's just not a thing that you can actually do. And same for, you know, working at the box office. Well, why can't I just have the seats that I want? Well, someone else purchased them 6 months ago, so I can't just kick them out. There's always a reason, almost always. Sometimes people are just lazy, and the reason that they're not doing whatever is because they don't feel like it. But for the most part, that's not the case. For the most part, there's an actual reason why I can't give you a huge shot. There's an actual reason why I'm suggesting maybe not sparklers at noon. I don't know. And now I'm in this great job where I make art, and I'm now in a position where I can be the manager that I learned not to be from all of those serving jobs and barista jobs. It's great. You know, all of these jobs, some were great and some were not so great. Some I was really great at, some I wasn't that great at. But I learned something from everyone, so that's good. But now, you know, I'm in a position where I'm kind of a boss lady, and I still get why don't you just suggestions. You know, oh, you have a theater? That's awesome. Why don't you just do Hamilton? Yeah. And if I try to explain to them about how the rights aren't available yet, how our stage is literally too small to hold the cast that it requires, they're like, yeah, but people would really like it. And it's frustrating when you feel like you're in a position to either say, great idea, when you know it's not, or you feel like you're in a position to be like, well, here's the reason why that won't work. And most people are not interested in the reasons why they won't work. They're mostly interested in their brilliant idea and how they just made your whole life really, really great. So in addition to all of these jobs, why don't you justs, over the last decade, there are also really personal why don't you justs that come up. Why don't you just have kids? First of all, none of your business. Second of all, I've gotten to the point now that, basically once I turned 30, I was like, mate, I don't have to be nice to anybody anymore. And I am nice to people. But I've also kind of stopped being polite when I don't need to be. If a stranger asks me, why don't you just have kids? I might be honest with them and tell them I have severe depression and anxiety. I am very spunky, that's very true. I'm also medicated. and I don't necessarily want to pass that down to a child. I also have a history of other mental issues and mental disorders in my family. I know from watching my mother, who's the most amazing person in the world and who has raised my severely autistic brother like an absolute effing hero, it's not something that I want for myself. I love my brother. I would never trade him for anything in the world. He is so cool, and he knows the words to every Disney movie. He has the best life, and I love him, and I would never trade him. But it's not the life that I want for myself. And the most important reason is that I just don't effing want to. I love kids, I teach kids all the time, but I have never once had like a, oh gosh, I just wish there was a baby here. I don't. And at the end of the day, those are my reasons and they don't matter, but it's amazing and so delicious when I am honest with people and they get so uncomfortable. Like, they totally didn't expect me to say, well, I have depression and anxiety. Well, I have a severely autistic brother, and since we still don't know exactly what causes autism, if there is a cause at all, you know, and also, meh, and also, I just don't care. And that freaks people out. They think I must hate kids. I don't. I love kids. I am a little kid myself. I have two dinosaur tattoos. Of course I love kids. But it's very upsetting when people think, why don't you just, as if, like, having kids is just, like, an easy thing. Another thing that I hate, if you complain about your job even for a second, someone will say, well, why don't you just find another job? And I love that line from It's Always Sunny, like, yeah, I'll just go out to the job tree and pick a job off the job tree. Because, unfortunately, I graduated from college in 2009, so it was right after the recession started. That is the reason I didn't have health insurance. This is the first, this job that I have had for the past 2 years, this is the first job I have ever had that offered health insurance. Between the time that I was kicked off my parents' insurance and when the Affordable Care Act became available, I did not have health insurance. I didn't go to the doctor when I was sick. I recently have had to have two vocal surgeries, which was really important, you know, for me, because I'm a singer and I love to sing. I'm finally back to singing a little bit. I'm almost back to my full voice. It's not quite there. I'm still kind of in like a bassy range. But I looked at my bill for that, for those two procedures, which was outpatient. I wasn't under. I was totally awake. I was actually holding my own tongue out so that the guy could go in and do what is his business. With insurance, everything included, I have had to pay $400 for all of that. Without, it would have been $26,000. And so, jumping back in time, about a year after my husband and I met, we were just dating at the time, our apartment burned down in New York City. We lost everything that we had. We did not have renter's insurance. I ended up with some third-degree burns on my face and hands. It was the worst. Fast forward some time, I finally, like, calmed down and stopped freaking out every day. I'm working at a restaurant that is not the greatest. Some shifts, I'll work there all night and walk away with $20. When my rent is sky high, that's really bad. When I'm working 5 days a week and I might maybe only make $100 that week, that's nowhere near what I can make for my rent. So I was very, very stressed. Got my schedule shifted around, and I found that on Tuesdays I was working during the day all of a sudden. And all of a sudden, I started having panic attacks at work every Tuesday. And I couldn't really figure out why, because nothing terrible was happening. No one was making me cry or have a panic attack. And then I realized that was the day they roasted the chickens. And the smell reminded me of my skin and hair did after the fire. And that was awful. It was almost a year out from the fire. I thought I was over it, and it was still affecting me so much. My boss at the time saw me in downstairs during having a panic attack, asked why I wasn't up on the floor. I tried to give him a kind of a shortened version. You know, I think I have PTSD. You know, I survived a fire. But I mean, at this point, I am still financially rebuilding ourselves. We had to repurchase everything that we owned in the most expensive city in the world. And it was terribly hard. And my boss was like, well, if it's affecting you this month, why don't you just get therapy? And I said, with what money, Jeff? I don't have health insurance. The insurance that you offer is completely unrealistic. I can't afford it. And also, I'm working 5 to 6 days a week and not making any money. How do I do that? And he didn't have an answer for me. All he wanted was to be the hero who swept in and suggested therapy. And I'd be like, therapy? I've never heard of it. Yes, please. This sounds great. So I think that is kind of what I've learned over the past decade, is that I need to stop saying, why don't you just? And I hope everyone else thinks twice about saying that, because everybody is going through stuff. Everybody's job is hard. Everybody's life is difficult. Everyone is going through struggles that you don't understand or see. And maybe you won't be able to see them because maybe their struggle is invisible. Maybe it's like depression or anxiety or PTSD. Or maybe they're just having a really, really terrible day and they don't need you to tell them to smile. So I think that's what I've learned over the past decade is just be cool to everybody, because it's hard for everybody, and we're all in it together. Thank you.
Okay. So, I don't know how many of you know, I turned 40 this year. Well, I'm going to in like 2 months. And what have I learned in this past decade? I'm a lot different at 40 than I was at 30. I mean, I grew up in a small town, and I always wanted this big, huge life. I wanted to meet interesting people, do interesting things, and I did it. You know, like, I was the kind of person who's, like, best friends with a girl named Cleopatra, who's, like, a trapeze artist who identifies as a vampire. You know, like, I want to do these interesting things. And now that I'm 40, like, I find the most interesting people are just regular people I turn to, you know, like, you don't have face tattoos or green hair or play in like a punk band. I mean, but you all have these amazing stories to tell, and you just live your lives, and you're these amazing people. And all I have to do is turn to you and say, like, so what's your story? And people are generous enough to share. And that's really cool. So thank you all for coming and listening. I think this is a really great event, and the fact that you took the time to listen and that you were brave enough to share, I'm glad I live here. Oh, well, I'm glad you're here.